It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, is Yemen falling apart? Yemen has been mired in crisis since the Houthi rebels' takeover of the capital Sana'a in September 2014 and the recent resignation of Yemeni President Abdel Rabu Mansour Hadi. His prime minister and the country's cabinet has thrown Yemen's political transition, once hailed as a model for the region, into chaos. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Under Hadi, the strategically located country, home to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP, one of the most dangerous franchises of the global terror group, has been a key Western ally. By seizing Sana'a, the Houthi rebels moved beyond their traditional rebellion in the north. Separatists continue to press their cause in the south, while militants from the AQAP continue to operate. The turmoil has also cast doubt over the future of a key partnership for Washington in the fight against AQAP. Ironically, just before the Houthi rebels captured Sana'a last September, President Barack Obama was touting cooperation with Yemen as a model in counterterrorism. AQAP claimed responsibility for shootings in January in Paris that killed 17 people and has been accused of plotting attacks against American interests. The crisis in the Arab world's poorest country threatens to create a power vacuum that could allow AQAP to expand while pushing Yemen toward a broader conflict between majority Sunni Muslims and minority Shiite Houthis who are hostile to both the United States and Al-Qaeda and who are purportedly backed by Saudi Arabia's nemesis, Iran. U.S. officials said training of Yemeni special forces had ground to a halt in the capital, though some joint activities were continuing in the Sunni-controlled south. Well, for more on the internal and external political ramifications of Yemen's implosion, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Nedwa Adawsari is a leading Yemeni expert on tribes and tribal conflicts and founder and executive director of the Sheba Center for International Development here in Washington. And Charles Schmitz. He's a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore and a senior fellow specializing in Yemen at the Middle East Institute. That's a policy group based here in Washington. And both guests join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Nedwa Adawsari, let me begin with you. Let's talk about the political situation in Yemen, the current situation. Why do you think President Hadi resigned in light of the Houthi rebel onslaught?
I think President Hadi simply could not function anymore, could not operate anymore. He's been under a lot of pressure from the Houthis, who controlled the government in September and who controlled every aspect of the decision-making in the capital. At the same time, they kidnapped his chief of staff, and there was an agreement in which Hadi accepted to revisit the constitution draft that Houthis were against.
And why were they against it?
They were against it because of different reasons, but most importantly, they were against it because it divided Yemen into six federations, and they were against that. But also, Houthis wanted more people in the supreme authority that oversees the implementation of the national dialogue process. And both demands Hadi agreed to, but Houthis did not release the chief of staff. And they took over the presidential palace, and they put him in a house arrest. So, I mean, he just couldn't deal with it. But I think, you know, the events in Yemen is a clear indication that the transition deal, the GCC deal that was supported by the international community and the U.S. government and the U.N. back in 2011 has clearly failed. I mean, honestly, myself as a Yemeni and many others saw it coming, not exactly Houthis taking over, but failing simply because this transition deal have maintained old regime elements. It granted former President Saleh immunity from prosecution. So he remained a major player in Yemen politics, and he remained, although not directly, but indirectly, in control of most of the security and military forces. And so Houthis managed with his help to eventually take over the capital and control Sana'a.
Let me turn to Charles Schmitz for your take on the recent events in Yemen. Do you also see this transition deal as being the root cause of what we're seeing now, this sort of political turmoil and upset, the fact that former president was given immunity from prosecution and then turned and decided to help these Houthi rebels who, of course, are opposed to, you know, the transition deal? How do you see things?
Yeah, what we're seeing is the end of the transition. And what we're really seeing is a shifting of the underlying politics. The transition deal was backed by the GCC and the Group of Ten, Europe, the UN, and the United States. And it was based on an interim government that really was the old regime. It was split. Ali Abdullah Saleh's inner circle split. The Islah Party was in opposition. And those two components, they're the ones that made up the government. So really, it was Ali Abdullah Saleh's old government, although some of it had split off and were mad at him, you know. But that was the basis of the regime. And the two sort of new components in the Yemeni power structure were the Ansar Allah, the Houthi in the north, and the Hirak, the Southern Secessionist Movement. And those are two areas that both experienced war with the Saleh regime. And both areas, Saleh was not able to incorporate them into his power structure. He tried, but he couldn't do it. And those two failures led to his ouster. The final straw was, of course, his inner circle splitting in two. And the GCC agreement sort of kept the government as it was, and then added the Southerners and the Ansar Allah in the national dialogue, which was to come up with a new constitution to have elections for the following government. What happened is in the interim period, a number of things went on. First, the government was completely incapable of doing anything. It was so caught up with party politics in the institutions that it was paralyzed and there was nothing going on. The economy was deteriorating and the security situation was really bad. And secondly, Ansar Allah seems to have made a decision about a year ago.
Now, Ansar Allah, you're talking about the Houthis.
Houthi is the term that the media uses for the Ansar Allah. Ansar Allah calls itself Ansar Allah. Abdul Malik al-Houthi is the leader, and they took from him and his brother, the original leader, they took from him the name to say, oh, these are the Houthis. But the Houthis refer to themselves as Ansar Allah. And Ansar Allah, about a year ago, made a decision that they were going to take matters into their own hands. They began an offensive. First, they threw out the Salafi Dar al-Hadith in the north in Damaj. Then they moved down to Amran. And Amran was important because it was sort of the head of the Al-Ahmar family's leadership of the Hashid Tribal Confederation. It was also where a key ally of Ali Muqsun, a military unit with the Salak. So it was sort of the heart of the part of the Salak regime that had broken off. And they were the principal enemies, at least initially, of Ansar Allah. And they took Amran militarily, and then they came down to Sana'a. And so they have sort of thrown out the Islah Ali Muqsun Al-Ahmar family component of the government and replaced it. So instead of having the old part of Ali Abdullah Saleh's regime and the Islah component, now we have Ali Abdullah Saleh and the Houthis splitting power. The crisis, as Nudwa said, was about the constitution's division of the country, because that came out of the national dialogue. The division of the country was not agreed upon by the delegates to the national dialogue. The Southerners didn't agree with what was coming up. The Southerners wanted a division of Yemen into the two former states and then as a federation. And the Ansar Allah objected because their key region in Sada was joined with Sana'a to make them a very small minority. And also they wanted access to the Red Sea and they were cut off. So it appears that the design of the states was against them. But their reaction was to kidnap the chief of staff and then overrun the presidential palace where Hadi has never lived, but then surround his house, attack his guard force, and basically place him under house arrest. And even though President Hadi agrees to their demands, they still don't withdraw. This is ridiculous. And no government can do this.
Okay, so what about that, Nedwa Dalsari? How is it that the Houthis still didn't agree to, or rather remained, you know, in the presidential palace or capture the presidential palace, even if President Hadi was in agreement with their basic demands? I mean, what are they looking for?
I think there's a huge distrust issues among the different political players. I mean, Houthis don't trust anybody, including Saleh. They've been fighting the government since 2004. They've made it to the capital. Now they're in control. Now they're people who call the shots. So I think it's very hard for them to, like, give all that away easily. At the same time, this is an extremely young movement. They lack the political maturity to strike constructive dialogue with others. And that's clear in their decisions and what they've been doing ever since they've taken over the capital. So I think it's a combination of lack of experience and at the same time, distrust of other political players.
And Charles Schmitz, to what extent are the Houthis backed in effect by Iran? They are a Shiite group. Talk about their affiliation with the Shia Islam, and also talk about Zaydi, which is I believe it's an ethnic group in Yemen. It's an indigenous group. No.
It's a religion.
It's a religion.
Yes, it's a religion.
We need to understand, you know,
Those are two key questions, both the relationship with Iran and the meaning of Shia here. They're described often as a rebel Shia group. Abd al-Malik al-Houthi, the Houthi family, it's a family that has a long line of prominent religious scholars in the Zaydi tradition. And the Zaydi tradition is an offshoot of Shiism.
And very much part of Yemen's identity.
Yes, it has a long history in Yemen. The imamate that ruled Yemen for 1,000 years from the Saada region was based on Zaydiism, the Zaydi elite. The movement began a long time ago, literally as college students that were trying to revive Zaydi practice because Zaydiism had been attacked by the Republican regime. Zaydiism was seen as the basis of the aristocracy in Yemen under the imamate, and the Republicans, though themselves Zaydi, they were for equality and equal citizenship and a formation of a republic. And so they welcomed other religious currents as well. For example, Wahhabism and Salafism that came from Saudi Arabia and came with support. The Yemeni state was very poor and it couldn't do education, and so the Saudis donated and they had education, but part of the education was these new Wahhabi currents, which are Sunni currents that come in from Saudi Arabia.
And when did this start?
This starts in the 70s, in the 70s and 80s, and was seen as an attack on Zaydiism. And the Zaydi elite, they had kind of a problem because part of Zaydiism is that the leader of the Islamic community must be a member of the bloodline of Fatma and Ali. And this is what makes the Zaydi elite stand out. They are in the bloodline of Fatma and Ali, and therefore they are eligible to be. The Republic, of course, all citizens are equal, and anyone can be elected president. And so they don't quite know politically, socially, theologically, how to fit into the new Yemen. And they're grappling with this. And then in the late 80s, early 90s, literally some college students, they started kind of a Zaydi revival movement. I mean, using cassettes and stuff to revive among the very large youth group inside of Yemen, revive the practice of Zaydiism and defend it against what they saw as the attacks on an old Yemeni tradition.
Okay, now on to Iran.
Well, wait. It transforms in the sense that that's how it began, as kind of a revival movement. Then in the 2000s, Hussein al-Houthi, who was a member of parliament, the brother of Abd al-Malik, the current leader, he militarized the movement. Although all Yemenis have weapons, it's not hard to do, but he organized the movement militarily. He said, we're going to have to defend ourselves. And he provoked the president. He's the one that went down to the mosque right after the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And he went down to Sana'a and he started the movement's chant, which is death to America, death to Israel. Curse the Jews, long live Islam. And that is not meant to be hostile to the United States, though it sounds it. It is meant to poke a finger in the president, because the president was defending the Americans in Iraq. The president was defending anti-terrorism campaign of President Bush and whatnot. And so this was meant to say, hey, we are independent of everyone. We are not a foreign force. We are authentically Yemeni. And the president, of course, overreacted. They went in with heavy military force, and the Houthi were able to fend off 6 wars against the Yemeni state. The wars themselves gave the Houthi leadership credibility, because they were able to withstand against the onslaught of the government. And the government was scorched earth policy, alienating lots of people that were up there. So the key component of this is that the Houthis are credible leaders. And the people they now recruit to fight are not fighting for Zaydiism. They're not fighting for religious. They're fighting because this is a credible leadership of Yemen. And Yemenis are looking for credible leadership. Their taking of Sana'a was largely because people were fed up with the transitional government. They came into Sana'a saying that they wanted to reform the government and implement actually the national dialogue.
To what extent are they backed by Iran, and what is the ideological relationship?
The Iranians early on in the Houthi rebellions said, we support our brothers, our Shi brothers, and we defend the right of our Shi brothers for their religious practice in Yemen. But that was about it. And it's not clear how much there is relationship. The one consequence that I do see of Iranian support is funding, because their militias have grown tremendously in the last year, and those militias grow through payments. People are being paid to fight. And there's just not that much money in Yemen. People say, oh, they're getting from local taxation. There's not much to tax in that area. They're getting funding, and that's what's enabling them to expand militarily so greatly.
So quickly, before I go to a break, Ned, would you have anything to add or subtract with respect to Iran?
I think with regard to Iran, I think also another thing is that the level of sophistication by which Houthis are operating suggests also some training from Iran.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Nedwa Al-Dawsari. She's a leading Yemeni expert on tribal conflicts and founder and executive director of the Sheba Center for International Development based here in Washington, from whom you just heard, in Charles Schmitz. He's senior fellow specializing in Yemen at the Middle East Institute. That's a policy group based in Washington. We're talking about the crisis in Yemen, the threats from both the Houthi movement and AQAP, and ramifications for regional stability. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or keep up with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a longtime loyal listener from Lagos, Nigeria, Goodness Chidi Nkwolo. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email with comments to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Nedwa Al-Dawsari. What about now? The country seems to be very divided. We have separatists in the south. The AQAP continues to pose a major threat, and we know the Houthis are opposed to them. Mm-hmm. We have the Houthis now in Sana'a. Nobody's really in control. What are the prospects of reconciling all these groups, and particularly is the role of the UN envoy Jamal Ben Omar significant?
You know, I mean, I think you hear a lot about Yemen in the news. What you don't hear is that this is an extremely poor country. A third of the population struggle to afford food. The unemployment rate is at 50%, and that's because we've had a very corrupt government. We've always had one of the most corrupt governments in the world. The GCC deal in 2011 simply recycled corrupt political officials and put them back in power. These are the same corrupt officials that the Yemenis took to the streets to protest against in 2011. Also with regard to AQAP, I think what's happening now in Yemen is a continuation of power struggle between traditional political actors, including Houthis. And what's happening in Sana'a right now seems to be distant from issues that matter to the rest of the population in the south, in the north, in Taiz, in tribal areas. Even the talk about AQAP, people say that Houthis are opposed to AQAP. They are opposed, yes, I agree. But at the same time, Houthis' actions to fight Al-Qaeda in tribal areas have antagonized local tribes, and they've forced the tribes to join hands with Al-Qaeda in order to stop Houthis from taking over their areas. For the tribe, Houthis are outside aggressors who want to exercise authority over them and take over their power. Also, a very important aspect of the Yemeni history and Yemeni politics, we don't have a sectarian problem, but then areas that are dominated by Shafi'i Sunni population that have always been very sensitive towards Zaydi, North Zaydi hegemony, in this case, it's the Houthis. I think any agreement that happens in Sana'a that does not respond to the needs of the larger population, that doesn't address the governance issues, that doesn't address corruption, is doomed to fail. I think it's very important for the international community, for the UN envoy, to keep that in mind while they try to kind of steer up the negotiation between political actors.
Turning back to you, Charles Schmitz, for your take on the situation now with the country being so divided and what prospects there are for any kind of negotiated settlement given these divisions within the country and, of course, the geopolitical ramifications. You have Saudi Arabia worried about the Houthi rebels in charge since they are backed in many ways by Iran, the nemesis of Saudi, and now we have a transition in Saudi Arabia. And then, of course, the United States has counterterrorism interests. But as Nedwa was saying, unless there's some sort of a reconciliation and a stronger economic development, it's hard to see how, whether it's counterterrorism, fighting AQAP, can actually be successful.
I think one key is, Nedwa pointed out, that the Houthi lack political maturity. And I characterize this as the Houthi don't know what they're doing, that there are various factions and wings. Mm. And the military wing seems to be dominant. But the political wing knows that it can't rule Yemen alone, that it needs the state. And in fact, it's ironic that they put the president under house arrest in order that he stay in power. They wanted him to stay in power. You know, it's kind of strange to have a coup that puts the government back into power. That's what they were doing. And they did that because they know they need the national government. They were upset when the southern region resisted them, and resistance grew in Sana'a. In the east, the eastern tribes have allied with Islaq and Saudi Arabian backing, gearing up for a big battle out there. And so the Houthi have sort of run up against the extent of their military expansion, and now they have to pull people in. They were upset that people that signed the agreement that they put together in September didn't stay with them. They need that. And so they're going to have to learn now to compromise politically, particularly because the Saudis are backing the eastern tribes. They may back the southerners as well. And the Houthi know that they cannot rule a country alone. And so in the best case scenario, what happens is the political wing of the Houthis are able to negotiate some kind of a deal that pulls everybody back into a political process where everybody has some degree of trust in the state.
Well, back to you, Nedwa Adavsari. Where do you think things are going from here, and what do you think Saudi Arabia intends to do, and Iran? And what about what happens to U.S. counterterrorism efforts against AQAP? Because AQAP, of all the al-Qaeda franchises, is the one that poses the greatest threat to the United States. It has proven that it can attack. What about that?
Okay, so with regard to the Saudis, I mean, the Saudis had a lot of influence, nearly controlled Yemen politics for 3 decades. But Saudis controlled Yemeni politics through a patronage network of tribal, political, and religious leaders. What happened is that in 2011 and now in 2014, their political patronage network nearly dismantled with the Houthis takeover. The Saudis have never been interested in a strong state in Yemen, and that's because they always saw that as a threat. Yemen is a republic. It's not a monarchy. Yemen has a democratic system, whether it's functioning or not, that's a different story. But Yemen has had elections before. Also, Yemen was one of the Arab Spring countries. And so the Saudis fear that any success story in Yemen will incite some sort of, you know, demands for reform and perhaps an Arab Spring version in Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis tried to kind of reinstate their political patronage network in 2011 in the GCC initiative. And what happened is that Houthis took over the capital city. And with that, the Saudis' patronage network completely dismantled, leaving the Saudis with very little leverage over Yemen politics. I think Saudis have paid the ultimate price of their miscalculations and wrong policies in Yemen that's happened over the past 3 decades. The Saudis still have leverage because they're the ones who have the money. The Yemeni government has pretty much lived on life support from Saudi Arabia over the past 4 years. Saudis have pumped at least $4.5 billion each year to the central bank in Yemen to keep the economy afloat and to make sure that government employees are paid. They still have that leverage, and they could use it to encourage political actors, including the Houthis, to come to an agreement. The Saudis could use that to encourage a good settlement for the current situation in Yemen. Now, whether they would do that or not, I don't know. But for now, the Saudis have decided to build the fence to insulate themselves from Yemen. And also, they said that they will not support the Yemeni government anymore because Houthis have taken over. And in my opinion, that's counterproductive. And it will fire back at Yemen, but also at the Saudis at the same time. With regard to AQAP, I think it's clear that the U.S. policy to counter terrorism in Yemen has failed. 15 years of support to President Ali Abdullah Saleh and then President Hadi did not make much difference. Al-Qaeda is still strong and even stronger. Al-Qaeda spreads in Yemen not because the government is weak. It's because the government is corrupt. When the military launched offensive in Shabwa in the south back in April, elements of the Harak movement, which is a secular movement, joined hands with Al-Qaeda to fight the Yemeni army. That's because they see the government as illegitimate. So the U.S. government needs to understand that Al-Qaeda and security problems in Yemen do not stem from culture. They stem from governance issues. They stem from grievances that until today remain largely unaddressed. So for the future, I think two very important things to keep in mind in terms of fighting Al-Qaeda. Number one, a central government is unlikely going to be effective. We've tried that for 15 years and it didn't work. Not just because it's weak, but also because it's hugely corrupt. It will likely remain like that for a while to come. So central government is not the response. I think the response should be with supporting local authorities who are more accountable to the people and they have more incentive to improve conditions in their area. But also equally important to keep in mind is that you cannot fight Al-Qaeda in tribal areas without the support and the buy-in of the local population and the local tribes. And what Houthis are doing is exactly the opposite. They're antagonizing the local opposition. Yemen had a huge success story in terms of fighting Al-Qaeda in mid-2012 when the local tribal militia in Abyan, by the name of the popular committees, managed to push Ansar al-Sharia out of Abyan with the help of the Yemeni government. So I think it's important to keep that in mind.
Well, those are excellent points, and I'm going to turn now to Charles Schmitz. For the last word, Charles, with respect to all of these questions, what happens to U.S. counterterrorism efforts against AQAP now that the Yemeni government has collapsed? And also, what about, you know, Saudi Arabia? Would you agree with Nedwa that their role has not been that helpful, and they are interested in a weak Yemeni government, but now that the government has collapsed and they're seeming not to have a communication channel with the Houthis, this is also counterproductive. And what will Iran do? Will they try to bolster their position vis-a-vis Yemen, and that then would antagonize the Saudis more? Are we looking at a very dangerous situation in the region, a very escalating one, and almost like a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, there's a danger of that, particularly in the eastern desert, where there's kind of been clashes off and on, and where there's large forces on each side amassed for the last 2 weeks or so. That is a danger in Yemen. I would say in terms of the counterterrorism, I'm not sure much is going to change. There was a training program in Sana'a that has been cut. But American forces are in the south, and they can come out of Djibouti as well. There's still going to be drone attacks. There was one recently in the Shabwa Marib region. So I suspect that's going to continue. I agree that it hasn't been all that effective because al-Qaeda's leadership seems to be able to reorganize, and they seem to have the funds to recruit people. So thus far, although the two missions where they rescued hostages and then lost the two hostages, that shows that al-Qaeda has had some security breaches, which they are prone to. They seem to lose a lot of their momentum to security breaches. In terms of Saudi Arabia, their patronage networks have undermined the building of the Yemeni state. And that's a key feature of the Yemeni state, is it's more a patronage network than it is an actual state.
Yemen, so a lot of corruption.
Yemen. Well, yes, it's more that institutions need to be built. Institutions need to work. That's the key thing. The Saudis haven't been all that great in helping that. The Saudis, though, I think still have large leverage because of the money, but also because they back the eastern tribes and they can help the southerners as well. And those are two key political components that the Houthi need in order for the country to sort of put itself back together.
I see. And one quick question before we close, and that is the South. Do you see the Southerners trying to secede? You know, will they take this opportunity of chaos and try to secede from the fragile state?
Well, the difficulty is the Southerners. They're not one. They're very split.
I see.
And so most of the government officials that are in, government and military officials that are in the South, they support the President Hadi. And President Hadi is against secession. And so it's a decision that's split among the Southerners. And so it's going to be difficult to succeed at this point.
All right. Well, there's a lot going on in Yemen, and everything is still unsettled. We will be following the story in the many weeks and months to come. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Nedwa Adawsari. She's founder and executive director of the Sheba Center for International Development, and Charles Schmitz, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. Thanks so much for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wojtek Zorniak. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.